we'll be producing oil for decades, but we won't be able to produce oil at the level we are at the moment, and we certainly won't be able to produce conventional crude oil in larger amounts, as some people feel. But oil is an absolutely fundamental material. It's exquisite and unique. It carries a very high energy density. It's easy to distribute and transport. It runs virtually all of the world's transportation. We rely on it to grow all our food, to transport our food around from farms to import it into the country. It's almost instructive to look around a room and try and find something that doesn't depend on oil, or plastic materials, computers, mobile phones, pharmaceuticals, everything. We rely on oil entirely. So running out of it, or running short of the cheap stuff, is likely to have considerable consequences. This is an almost simplistic slide in the sense that it compares energy resources one for another. But what you can see is that the green component of that energy mix accounts for something like 2/5 of all the energy used by human beings on Earth. Then you see gas and coal. Each of those accounts for about 1/4, and then hydroelectric and nuclear power about 6% each. And maybe it's 2%, but it's a rather small quantity of the total energy mix that is provided by renewable energy. So geothermal, solar, wind, wood, all that kind of thing. So we're utterly dependent on the fossil fuels in the energy mix as things stand. But the particular aspect of oil is that oil is refined into liquid transportation fuels, among other things. So without oil, then our transportation begins to look a bit sick and grind to a halt. And although you can run vehicles on gas and on coal, to actually start to switch over the 34 million cars we've got on Britain's roads to one of these other energy sources directly would not be feasible. This is the world use of energy from a 40-year period from 1965 to 2005. The green curve at the top is oil. You can see that over that period of time, by the end of it, the world was using about 2.5 times as much oil as it was at the start. It was using about twice as much coal and about 3 times as much gas. And then the purple line at the bottom, you see the rise of the nuclear power industry and a gradual increase in hydropower. But our dependence and use of fossil fuels is absolutely relentless. Now, you've probably heard of peak oil. It does seem to find its way in the news these days. It wasn't mentioned for quite a few years, but if you look at the green curve at the bottom, that's oil production in the United States. And you can see that peaked in about 1970. Now, Europe, basically that's the North Sea fields, they peaked in about 1999. Russia is complex because there was a turn down in the demand for oil when the communist regime went the way it did. But Russia has also peaked in its production. And if you add that whole lot up together, this was a 2004 scenario, but actually things have come to pass fairly closely to that, and world oil production has been pretty flat since about 2005. So very likely we are close to that peak. But once we hit the peak, and there are good reasons for believing we are very close to it, then the supply of oil on the world markets begins to decrease relentlessly and forever. So these are the good old days. This is the Humphrey Jones giant gusher in Texas. And at that time, all he needed to do was to drill a hole in the ground, because an oil well doesn't just contain oil. It contains gas under high pressure. So when you drill through that surface rock and get down into what's below it, you don't hit a pool of oil. It's not quite as simple as that. It's not like drilling for water. But you drill down into a porous rock that actually contains the oil. But the pressure of gas then forces that out in this enormous jet of black gold. And at that time, all he needed was one barrel of oil's worth of energy to extract 100 barrels of oil tremendous. Very, very straightforward. Now the North Sea is yielding an EROEI, not 100 to 1, maybe between 11 and 20 to 1. The very heavy oil that comes out of Venezuela, maybe it's 3 to 1. So it's not the case that if we are at the production peak, at the point of peak oil, that we've used up half the oil that we had to start off with. The problem is that the oil that remains is going to be much harder and more energy intensive to get out of the ground. So that is a rider on this particular situation. The production of oil, the world produces somewhere over 30 billion barrels of oil every year. I can't imagine what 30 billion barrels of oil or anything else looks like. It's an absolutely astronomical quantity. It works out to about 84 million barrels a day, and about a quarter of that is used up by the United States alone. The major producers are Saudi and Russia, and between the two of them, they produce something like a quarter of the world's oil. Oil isn't a single substance. It's light or heavy. Light oils, they have a consistency, almost something like vegetable oil. They're light in colour. They're very low in viscosity. The very heavy oils are basically some of the stuff that comes out of the Orinoco Belt, for example, in Venezuela. It's like the stuff that goes on the road. It's not liquid at all. It's a very, very heavy, tarry, bituminous kind of material. Now, some oils contain more sulfur than others. The sweet oils are low in sulfur. The sour oils, again, the heavy oils tend to be high in sulfur. They're much more difficult and more energy intensive to process. And because much of the oil that remains in the world to be accessed to us in future relies on a different kind of processing than the lighter oils. Light petroleum peaked in about 2005, but the heavy oils will require a new generation of oil refineries to be built. So we need a lot more technology to exist on the oil that we have already. And it's the light sweet oil that is best to refine into petrol. And there's a lot of this in Saudi, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Algeria. And I heard something interesting this afternoon, that apparently America has asked Saudi if they can increase their oil production because they're predicting that with the sanctions that they plan to impose against Iran, that there will be a fall in oil onto the world markets. Whether the Saudis can produce more oil is a moot point, because it's not clear exactly how much oil they have under their sands. These are different oil samples. This is an exhibit taken from the Norwegian Museum of Science and Technology in Oslo. You could see it more clearly if you were actually standing looking at it, but you can probably see that some of them are lighter in colour. They're certainly lighter in viscosity, and that they vary a lot in their chemical composition. They've got different molecules, different physical properties. And you don't have to drill in regions that are too disparate from one another to recover oils that really have quite distinct properties. So it's an amazing and multifarious material, crude oil. Now, oil is needed to produce most of the world's food. What you can see here is an array of combine harvesters working in a field in the Midwest somewhere. And you can see the quality of the soil, that it's almost like dust. And if we didn't put into that so much in the way of chemical fertilizers and so on, then that kind of soil would yield very little, actually. But it's not just the running of the tractors and the combine harvesters, because very little food is actually used at source. It's transported around the entire world. So we rely on oil to actually access what's produced in the first place, too. These are 98 oil-producing countries at the top there. And what you can see now, the ones in red, those are those countries that have passed their peak in oil production. In other words, they produce more oil at one time than they do now. So you can see Russia has passed its peak. Australia, America, Alaska, Mexico should certainly be on there now, because the Cantarell field is failing. And the only place that's doing very well, some of the African countries, and Saudi. Saudi still has an awful lot of oil. But it's inevitable that these existing countries in green are going to peak in their oil production. So this seems to be the way we're all going in terms of conventional crude oil. This looks a bit more complex than it is. The green curve, this is the discovery of oil going back to about 1930. And if you sum the area under those spikes, you end up with 2 trillion barrels of oil reckoned to be lying under the earth for us to access. Well, the red curve is the production of oil, and of course that refers to that same 2.2 trillion barrels. And clearly, this must peak at some point or another. But once you hit the production peak, the dotted line shows the relentless demand for oil. And clearly, once you hit the peak, supply drops against rising demand. So you have a huge gap between the two. So the price of oil is going to go through the roof, and the availability of it is going to be a matter of speculation. So if we rely on crude oil as we do, then we are likely to run into a problem. So some people would say, well, okay, why can't we just turn over and run the UK on hydrogen? Well, you'd need about 70,000 5-megawatt wind turbines, or a band about 25 miles wide around the entire coast of the UK. Because what you'd need, rather than making your hydrogen from steam reforming natural gas, which is how it's normally made, you need clean hydrogen. So you need to do it by splitting water, by electrolysis. So your electricity has to be clean. So if you were going to do that from wind power, this is the kind of scale you'd need. And if you were to build one new wind turbine, stick one of these up every day, it would take 180 years. So you're really talking about long-term technology. So I'm not knocking hydrogen, I just don't think it's going to come to our aid in the immediate future. Sugar beet. Okay, sugar beet grows very well in this country. This is a field of sugar beet growing in Norfolk. So the idea now would be to get the sugar out of the sugar beet, ferment it into ethanol, separate the ethanol from the water by distillation or some membrane process. But still, even if we turned over the entire nation's cropland to growing sugar beet and didn't grow any food, we could still only match half the fuel requirement that we get out of petroleum at the moment. So it's a considerable quantity. And you always have this competition, if you like, between growing crops for feeding people or feeding vehicles when you start to get onto biofuels based on land-based crops. It's even worse if you start to look at biodiesel. For example, if you wanted to grow rapeseed, you get about 1 ton of biodiesel per hectare. But we need about 30 million tons of it. And that's if you converted all the vehicles to diesel engines. Because if you did that, you get more miles for your gallon of petrol than you do from spark ignition engines. But you would still need something like 6 times the amount of arable land we have to provide that amount of fuel that we currently refine out of petroleum. So we could only meet 1/6 of our requirement. So the problem is the absolutely colossal quantities of petroleum that we get through, and petroleum-based fuels in particular, along with all the other uses that we have. And there's no easy replacement for it. Another issue, this is water, EROWI, energy yield on water invested. So basically, in relative terms, this is the amount of water needed to produce 1 megawatt hour of energy by various means. Well, if you look at the top, petroleum extraction, oil refining, even oil shale surface retorting, you're down in the tens or the hundreds. But if you get down the bottom, corn ethanol irrigation, soybean, biodiesel irrigation, you're up into the millions. So not only would there be a huge pressure on land to produce biofuels in the level that we use petroleum-based fuels at, but there's a huge pressure on water as well. So that's another thing to place into consideration among the whole sum of questions. This might not look like the most prepossessing stuff. This is green algae. Green because it contains chlorophyll that undergoes photosynthesis. But believe it or not, there are definite advantages to using algae. For a start, you get much higher yields per hectare, per unit area. You'd have to grow it in tanks of some kind. I mean, some people are even speculating there's a project at Cranfield University where the engineers there, they have some designs for floating these tanks on the open sea so they don't need to worry about using up land. The good thing, too, is you don't need to use cropland because you could place these tanks anywhere. But again, it's going to take an enormous amount of engineering. You don't need fresh water either to grow the algae on. You can grow them on wastewater and saline water. So altogether, they do have various advantages. So there we are. This is the kind of material that is the most hopeful thing I've seen yet as far as biofuels is concerned, whatever it might look like. And one idea that I really like, this whole green structure, these are tanks of algae. And then you also have a sewage treatment plant and you have a fossil fuel power plant. So the fossil fuel powered plant is generating CO2, so you could feed that to the algae and that would help to cut down the CO2 emissions, which is something that we want to do anyway because of climate change and that complex issue. But also, by discharging phosphate into rivers, you end up with problems of algal blooms, for example, which seems to be a difficulty, for example, off the coast of Norfolk. So actually getting the phosphorus out of wastewater is expensive. But if you could get rid of the phosphorus by feeding it to algae, same with the CO2, and produce some biomass product that you could use usefully to get fuel and other things from, then I think that would be a win-win situation. But again, the engineering has to be got up from scratch. But I think algae are a better option, possibly, than some others. So to basically conclude or sum up the thing, it doesn't seem that we can produce oil or a substitute from it on the scale that we use it now. So if we can't solve the problem from the supply side, then we've got to solve it from the demand side. We've got to reduce demand. And looking at, for example, the US Army has released a report where they, or the report anyway, the figures, seem to indicate that by the end of this year, 2012, there won't be any slack in the system. There won't be any excess oil against demand for it. And what's even worse is the prediction that by 2015, in 3 years' time, then the world will be short of its demand for oil by about 10 million barrels a day, which is a good 12% of what we get through at the moment. And if you look at the production curves that are predicted for oil, then within the end of two decades, say, then transportation is the one thing that's going to be hit hardest of all. And you can start to think that means a return to a more localised society from the kind of globalised village that we have at the moment, where we move everything around, where we import strawberries from the Seychelles in the middle of December, where we can have what we want, basically, because we can move it around, because we've got plenty of cheap fuel. So this process is called transition. And for example, it's going to be necessary to produce food locally because we won't be able to move food around the way we can at the moment. And I don't think we're going to get 34 million electric cars anytime soon. There's 34 million oil-powered cars around at the moment, although the government seems to want to put thousands of electric charging points around the country. I think it's going to be a while before we've got enough electric cars to make use of them. So I think the only way we're going to move people around sensibly by electric power is by having light rail systems and tram systems. So personalised transport is not looking to have a glorious future. But in terms of that energy mix, if we're living locally, then you can imagine so will the foot and the bicycle be part of our future. And this is a man in Sri Lanka who's taking his baskets to market under pedal power, and I think we will be going back to not the Stone Age exactly, but we will be far more directly involved with moving things around by simple means and locally. We'll need to work closer to home, whatever jobs might exist in 20 years. I mean, 70,000 people commute into Reading every day. 70,000 people commute out of Reading. It's almost a symbiosis. The interesting thing, I mean, you would think, well, the obvious thing would be to train the people in Reading to do the high-tech jobs in Reading rather than having to come in from outside. And most of the people who commute into London are office workers. So this seems to be a huge waste of fuel, in a sense, but maybe reskilling will be necessary. But as I say, will even these jobs exist in 20 years' time if the high-tech, the IT jobs are concerned with global companies that, as I say, might have long gone out of business? And cheap foreign holidays, well, I think they might well be a thing of the past in a decade or more. Peak phosphate, that's peak oil. We've also got a problem with peak phosphate. the kind of modern industrialised agriculture that we saw on one of the earlier slides, with the combine harvesters churning up the land in a kind of memory of the grapes of wrath, depends critically on rock phosphate fertiliser, and that is predicted to peak by 2030. So we're not running out of it immediately, but there is going to be a peak in production at certain foreseeable point in the future. Well, this industrialised agriculture is also highly dependent on synthetic nitrogen fertilisers, and these come from natural gas. That's where much of the world's hydrogen is actually used, liberated from methane, which is principally natural gas, and fresh water, and both those resources are already under stress. So as I said, food will need to be produced more locally because of the oil and fuel shortages. But something that interests me greatly is something called permaculture. And it's a whole kind of holistic philosophy. I'm trying to get my head around it and talking to people who know about this stuff. But what I like about it is it seems to be a much more efficient way of using inputs, if you like. You have much less in the way of inputs, so it's no-till farming, so you're not ploughing fields. The soil holds on to the phosphate and the nitrogen compounds much more easily. But also, we're going to need to recycle nitrogen and phosphorus from animal and human waste by composting, by using algae in wastewater filters, because we are just rather profligate in our use of resources and energy, and we won't be able to do that anymore. I've tried to get my head around trying to solve these problems from the resource side, and I think without tackling the demand side, I don't think there is a solution to this entirely. So this again is a vision of the future. We will see far more stuff grown locally and by recycling the phosphorus and nitrogen and so on. What if we don't do anything about it? Well, this is a slide put together by a friend of mine in the States, which I think is slightly tongue-in-cheek, but it does make a certain point. The line in the middle is 2005, which is when she produced this thing. But you can see after the war, there was the Korean War, we get up with the cheap energy boom, sex and drugs, rock and roll, Cold War victory, if that's what it was, the resource grabs. And then everything after 2005 is a prediction, but chillingly accurate. We see price spikes and profiteering, financial markets collapsing, unemployment and recession. And really, this red line is the production of oil. And the point being made here is if we just continue with business as usual and don't address the fact that we don't have unlimited supplies of oil, that we are likely to hit a production peak soon, then the result is likely to be a not too slow descent into anarchy, which I think would be best avoided personally. A happy ending. Well, I hope so. I think you've got a transition town movement in Oxford. They've got a website anyway. We've got one in Reading. Now, transition towns might be a bit on the idealistic side, but in a nutshell, what they're about is seeing what you can produce at a local level, local economies, food production, growing your own wood supplies, etc., etc., and what's often referred to as an energy descent action plan. So that's trying to come up with ways of living where we use a lot less energy. And as I say, transportation is the big problem because of the dependence of transportation on oil. There are other ways you can generate energy, particularly electricity and space heating, but oil is something quite special. So local initiatives of various kinds, sort of strengthening communities, sustainable jobs. As I say, what jobs will people be doing in 20 years' time? Because we could be in a completely different economy by then. But also practical skills. I think we've lost a lot of the practical skills in this country, and that's a terrible thing, because we're going to need them like never before. But a total rethink of how we live, and yeah, that's quite a challenge. Charles Kingsley is often quoted. You've probably heard of him. He was an interesting man. He was a university professor. He was a clergyman. He was a novelist. He was a great thinker about the human condition. And he said that we act as though comfort and luxury were the chief requirements of life, then what we actually need to make us happy is something to be enthusiastic about. And I think the reason this statement is quoted in terms of transition is that rather than going, oh God, we've had it, that we try and embrace this new age as something that might actually turn out better than our current circumstances are. In my worst moments, that's rather hard to believe, but I can see that we are looking toward tremendous changes because there's no choice. Finally, this was partly humorous. As I say, I used to work in the university system. I left it about 9 years ago. Do universities fit in with a future plan of retraining people and giving them the skills that they need? In other words, do we carry on letting people go to university, carrying on with the bums on seats funding, or is there some kind of strategy where we say, actually, we need 500,000 carpenters and 1 million plumbers and 2.5 million electricians. We don't necessarily need 200 people who graduated in David Beckham studies or something like this, because there is a whole plethora of courses available. I'm not knocking that, but I'm just suggesting that universities are going to... They've changed tremendously over the last 20 years, and I think they're going to have to change again for everybody's benefit. Anyway, the novel was a black comedy, but it does actually make the point that perhaps the system has lost its way somewhat in some places, and it needs overhauling. If you would like a copy, I have a few there. It got a Brit Writers Award nomination, which I was quite cheered about. It didn't win it, but never mind. It's got some good reviews, so as I say, if you would like a copy, there are a few available. Okay, so I'll end there. And what do we do when we start to run out of oil? Good question. Okay, thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. I think that's probably posed more questions than it's answered, but let's use that as a starting point. So we'll take about 5 to 10 minute break now and come round, as I said, with more nibbles and the collecting hat. Do come and have a look at the book if you want to, but we won't do selling until after the end of the evening, so if you can just put them back on the chair for now, that would be great. And thank you very much. See you in a few minutes.